Next up on the line, I believe we have Greg with the Utah Avalanche Center with today's Avalanche Report. Good morning, Greg.
So dry cold front moved through the region overnight. Temperatures have dropped. They're in the teens currently. And the winds really increased last night. West-northwest winds, especially at the upper elevations at 10,000 feet. Winds are averaging in the teens with gusts in the 30s. And 11,000 feet, gusts are in the 60s, including one 80-mile-an-hour gust. But they've been diminishing since about 5 a.m. and currently are averaging about in the low to mid-teens with some gusts in the 20s, and they should continue to diminish during the day today, which is certainly good news. No backcountry avalanches reported from Thursday, and today we're going with a normal caution, so that's an overall low danger. Two things you want to watch for. One, those strong winds that I just mentioned overnight, they may have created some isolated pockets of wind drifts at the mid and upper elevations, and although these drifts should be small, you want to avoid getting caught in one in any steep and consequential terrain. Secondly, strong sunshine today may produce some small wet avalanches on aspects facing east, south, and west. We call those solar aspects, as well as low and mid-elevation northerly slopes. I do think the temperatures are going to be cool enough today. There's going to be enough of a breeze to keep the snow surface cool, but I wouldn't be surprised if we did see some minor wet loose avalanche activity. For the upcoming weekend, it's looking, continued high pressure. You just heard a weather forecast a moment ago. So I'm expecting kind of continued wet loose avalanche activity over the weekend, but we may be setting up to a more active storm pattern by Tuesday or Wednesday. So we'll just keep our pay attention to that. And finally, this will be my final call into the KPCW forecast for Fridays. Look forward to talking to you again in the fall. But I just want to thank you and your listeners for tuning in. It's been a challenging winter. It's been a lot of avalanche fatalities and accidents. It's been a challenging winter, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be able to make people help people be aware of avalanche danger, and have really appreciated that people have been listening to the forecast and hopefully making correct decisions based upon that forecast. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate what all you guys do over at the Avalanche Center. Well, have a great summer, and we'll talk to you next fall then.
We'll talk to you in the fall. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And with today's trail report, Charlie Sturgis is actually out of town this week, so we have Chris from Mountain Trails on the line with us now to talk trails. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning. Let's see, Round Valley, we'll start with that. We're still melting out. It'll be melting out pretty quick, but we are definitely still dealing with some mud. It is mud season, so we're asking people to kind of just use some common sense, and if you encounter any significant mud, please turn around. Those north-northeast aspects are still going to be very wet. We're suggesting people, Dutch Hollow, Coyote, down in Heber, those trails are good to go. Draper and Corner Canyon. Sounds like those trails are riding really well. So, head on down there. Lower elevation is definitely dried out. Bonanza Flats this weekend, we will continue grooming. For those of you who are still skate skiing and fat biking, we'll groom both of those tracks up there this weekend for you. But we will be wrapping up those operations after this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it from me.
One quick question for you. With the spring weather coming out, a lot of people getting out with their dogs now, and a lot of animals waking up. I think we've heard some reports of coyote sightings in town. What do people need to be careful about when they're encountering wildlife, whether they're out on a trail run or out walking their dog?
Dogs are a big one. We definitely want you to have your dogs leashed. I mean, if you encounter something out in Round Valley, it is an off-leash open space, but make sure you have your leashes handy and keep your dogs under control. If you encounter like a moose or a coyote, just turn around and slowly walk away, especially up in Bonanza as well. We've gotten reports of some moose up there. Bonanza is on leash, so your dogs need to be on leash at all times up there. And again, if you encounter a moose, just turn around and go the other way.
All right, Chris, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Happy Friday. Well, the Utah's legislature recently passed new rules that allow cities to reappropriate tax dollars and invest in community redevelopment agencies. In Tuesday's meeting, Heber City Council authorized themselves as the reinvesting agency board. Carolyn Murray has this.
Redevelopment Agency, CRA, works with the school district and takes existing tax dollars and reappropriates that money to redevelopment in specific areas identified in Heber City. Councilmember Rachel Kaler said creating a CRA is a 20 to 30 year reinvestment plan that will ultimately bring more tax dollars to the school district. They submitted survey areas to the state for approval.
Is we're looking at the Main Street downtown area, plus up to 200 East and down to 200 West, also looking at 100 South, 600 West, and that would be around the Heber Valley Railroad area, and then also the North End, so where we've got Smith's and the Heber Appliance area, and then what we expect to see, Smith's Marketplace and more commercial development on the North End, and then the South End where Walmart is, but also down Daniels Road and then up 1200 South, which we have seen great commercial growth there.
She said the next step is to get approval from the school district to set aside tax revenues to be used in the defined survey areas.
So once that is defined and we arrange that and do all the paperwork and all the legalities of it, we will start pulling that what would normally go to the school district in those tax dollars would go into a fund that then the city would be able to purchase property or work with a business owner to redevelop his building or remodel his building.
Kaler said Heber's downtown needs improvement, but they don't have the money to do it.
And so this allows us to grow commercial development. And then in the long run, the school district will actually get those dollars back and more so because then they'll get the addition of whatever tax dollars come in because of the redevelopment. You know, everything that we've seen from, I think, St. George has been very effective in their CRA. And there's been several other cities. It's a fairly new program, so I think we're 2 years into the state legislation. But what we have seen in other states is it's been very effective for redevelopment.
The next Heber City Council meeting is on April 20th at 7 p.m. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's 8:15 on your Friday morning. Welcome to the Local News Hour. I'm Sean Higgins, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. First up in the Local News Hour this morning, we have Summit County Councilor and High Valley Transit District Board Member Roger Armstrong. Councilor, good morning.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
So let's jump right into it. High Valley Transit District, lots of meetings going on. It seems like you guys are still setting up service agreements and contracts. How's the progress going with all of that?
It seems to be coming along fine. I think, we knew that we were going to be on a fast track to get a lot of this done. And I think, you know, to the credit of Caroline Rodriguez and her staff and Via and Kim Carson, making sure that our wheels don't start to wobble, we're doing a good job of moving things forward as we need to.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain a little bit of the chain of authority here? You have Summit County and then the Transit District, and then we have this private firm, Via, that supplies services. How does that chain of authority work?
Yeah, good question. So under state law, for us to become a small transit district, which is what the county elected to do, we have to be an independent district. So while we have three county council representatives that sit on the board of the High Valley Transit District, the officers on that board have to be non-county council representatives. They can't be county legislators. So Kim Carson is the chair of the board. Joe Spink is the vice chair. Caroline Rodriguez serves as the general manager of High Valley Transit, which is appropriate because of her transit background and also because she is the county's transportation director. So that's the general structure. The county will oversee the budgets. The county has certain oversight is probably the wrong term, but the county has certain input. But this is, you know, an independent district and is able to run its own affairs. And as we continue to grow and become a more regional district, as we annex in other municipalities and perhaps partner with Wasatch County and others to form a larger, more regional transit district, that will become more apparent because there will be more board seats that will be filled by those individual jurisdictions, and it will start to shift a bit.
Mm-hmm. And as far as employment is concerned, for example, a bus driver for the district, are they employed by the county, the transit district, or VIA?
They'll be employed by VIA. And that was some of the work that we did yesterday, was finalizing that service agreement with VIA's subsidiary. They've got a subsidiary called River Road. So High Valley Transit entered into an agreement with VIA to provide the operations and maintenance of our transit system. And they're the experts at doing that. And frankly, I don't think we could have done this on anything approaching this timeline, from the time we essentially elected to do this late last year to now without that third-party expertise to help us implement quickly. They've got access to vehicles. They will sign contracts with drivers and third-party contractors. They'll obtain the insurance. They'll handle the marketing. They'll develop the app that will be crucial for running the system the way it's intended to run. So there are a lot of moving pieces that VIA will undertake for High Valley Transit on a contract basis initially. And this the service agreement that we entered into yesterday, which was an amendment of the Master Services Agreement, governs that process over the next 2 years and articulates, generally the budgets for that service, the insurance levels for that service, and then certain other legal issues that govern that relationship.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Thursday's meeting, you guys did take some action. You guys approved an interlocal agreement between Summit County and High Valley. What does that do?
That establishes the relationship. It also transfers certain assets. So Summit County, as you know, has had a relatively long-term relationship with Park City as it relates to transit. And Summit County receives certain funding through taxes. Summit County, we're working out our separation from Park City at this point. There will be some equipment that will come to Summit County from that process. There will be some real estate that will come to Summit County from that process, the Kimball Transit Center, certain other real properties, the Camas Valley Transit area where we pick people up and move them into the basin. All of those assets will then be transferred over to High Valley Transit, since they are the transit district. And under state law, they'll be entitled to receive many of those sales tax taxes that the residents of Summit County approve for transit. That will go directly to High Valley Transit. Some of those can be kept by the county, and some of those, as we move forward, the county may elect to retain some of those proceeds for transportation projects that may not fall directly under the purview of High Valley Transit, but will retain some flexibility to do that. So that's what that agreement is about, is to transfer those real properties, to set up the transfer of the monies and the revenue streams to High Valley Transit.
Right. And another topic being discussed is planning a microtransit service or a ride-on-demand system throughout the basin. How will that be structured? Will this be kind of more like Uber, where drivers supply their own vehicles and are essentially independent contractors, or is it a more formal service within the transit district?
I think it's more formal than certainly an Uber service, because the VIA will control the contracts with the drivers. The drivers will be using vehicles that High Valley Transit and VIA provides. They'll be branded High Valley Transit vehicles. They'll be maintained and inspected and licensed and all that good stuff by VIA. But the drivers themselves will be able to lease one of those vehicles to provide that Uber-like service, that on-demand kind of service within that service area that's been identified to do that. And, it's one of the more interesting parts of this process, and it's something that we've talked about at the county level for a long time, because of the way that the county has grown on on more of a sprawl basis historically, it makes it more difficult for fixed route transit to efficiently and economically serve, you know, the people that we would like to serve in the basin. And we've always thought that there's probably room for some kind of an on-demand service. And this is that attempt to provide that on-demand service within that area that's been marked on the route system for that service, which is, you know, in and around, I think, the Trailside area, the some of the Kimball Junction areas, Silver Springs, that area. And I'm probably mangling that a bit, but there's a designated area for that service. So a rider can call VIA, can call the dispatcher and say, I'd like to arrange a ride to be picked up. And much like you would experience, I think, with Uber, a driver would show up within a certain period of time, and there may be more than one driver to select from. I haven't seen that operational part of the app yet. I think they're still putting those pieces together.
Mm-hmm. And as far as a payment for the district is concerned, have we identified where the revenues are going to come from to fund the district?
Yeah, largely the revenues will come from the sales taxes that were approved by the voters. We'll have some federal funding in there, as always with transit. You know, you look for federal funding, there may be some state funding available. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens if the current presidential administration is able to make progress with the infrastructure proposals, because I assume that some of those will address transit and transportation issues, and there could be more funding from that. But at this point, it's primarily from the sales taxes and from the grant programs that Carolyn does a pretty good job of managing.
Mm-hmm. And another topic about separation agreements with Park City Transit. I know there's been some spirited discussions and meetings between Park City and Summit County when it comes to transit over the years. Has an agreement been reached with Park City Transit about what that agreement would look like once High Valley gets up and running?
Not yet. We're still in process. We're in active conversations about how to divide things up. I think we've tried to consolidate the issues at this point, and we're just trying to work through them and see, you know, where we wind up. I don't think it's going to be acrimonious. I mean, I think that there are, you know, issues related to funding, there are issues related to operations. We may have some, we likely will have some overlap, should have some overlap on, for example, on the white route. So we have to figure out what that looks like. What does operations of that look like? How does funding for that flow? So those are pieces we have to talk about. We have a long-standing history that involves fixed assets, and you know the county is going to need to figure out how to how to get, you know, its portion of those fixed assets, and on what basis, and which of those assets you know, are meaningful. So I think those conversations are starting among staff at this point, as much to sort of identify what the pieces are that we're going to be having to juggle. And then I think, you know, between now, we've got about 3 months to wrap this up. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that, you know, if we're close enough now on articulating what the issues are, then that negotiation, I anticipate we should be able to accomplish within that period.
Right. And if I could just take one step backward and talk about some of the costs for this district one more time. Is it correct that the cost for microtransit is about $2.5 million and the cost for fixed route is $7 million? Is that $7 million per route or $7 million altogether?
That's $6.9 and change total for all of it.
Gotcha. And you said that's being paid for through sales taxes, correct?
Correct.
Well, Roger, anything
else? Well, all that kind of that conglomeration of transportation and transit funding that we have access to, but I would say the lion's share of that is likely to be the sales taxes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As far as the actual routes are concerned, is that going to stay largely unchanged as it is now? Is it going to be expanded? Is it going to be cut down?
I think it's going to be, well, expanded is, I think it's going to be more efficient. So I think we're looking at run times of about 15 minutes instead of the typical 20 to 30 minutes that historically those routes have seen. And I think with the microtransit, we're going to be able to move people to those stations where they can either access a bus faster or without having to, you know, hit 17 stops in between a change or get a ride directly to their destination. But the fixed routes, I think, are going to run farther. So, for example, the Lime will start in the Jeremy Ranch area, and we'll continue on up into Deer Valley. So that's a significant expansion. And so I think our customers are going to have a much better experience than on the basin side than they have in the past, just because of the length of those rides as they were structured previously, and trying to accomplish that 100% with fixed route large bus transit just wasn't really practical. And I think that we can shrink down those run times, we can make it more convenient, and we can take people to destinations that they need to get to, such as Deer Valley, in a way that we haven't been able to do in the past.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to add this morning?
I think that's it. It's a work in progress. I would love to make a hard sell and say this is going to come out of the box July 1 absolutely perfect and is not going to have a single bug attached to it, but I'm sure that we'll have to have some time to work out bugs in the system, and we'll take feedback from our residents as we go. And I would just ask people to be patient with the process. And we've got some concerns that have been raised by people in Silver Springs about the service, the pink service being cut there and replaced with the micro transit. And I would just say it is a little bit different. It's a difference that we think will be a very positive difference for riders, and we would just ask people for patience. And it's hard for some people to have faith in government these days, but we ask for your tolerance, at least in the short term, and have a little bit of faith, and let's see if we can make things better than they are now.
All right, Councilor Armstrong, thank you so much. Enjoy your Friday.
Thanks, Sean. Be well.
All right, that's Roger Armstrong, Summit County Councilor and High Valley Transit District Board member. Well, good morning, everyone. It is 8:30 on your Friday morning. I'm Sean Higgins, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. Next up on the line, we have Trudy Breton. She's the Wasatch Behavioral Health Prevention Coordinator, and she has details about several upcoming community events for Mental Health Month. Trudy, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Pleasure to have you. So let's talk about this Live on Suicide campaign. So tell us about Mental Health Awareness Month, and what is Live on Suicide?
Okay, I would love to. So the Utah State Legislature saw suicide and mental health as a big enough issue that in the 2020 legislative session, the 2019 legislative session, they allocated some funding to address this problem. And so they offered some mini grants, and we wrote for a mini grant through our coalition to offer some mental health awareness education events in our community. And just to give you a little bit of background on it, when we look at kind of what the statistics are for mental health issues, nationwide, we kind of are always hearing it's a concern, it's a big problem. And Utah and even Wasatch County also are seeing the effects of mental illness in our area. And so about 5% of all residents in Wasatch County suffer with some sort of a mental illness, like depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, those types of things. And even our youth, we've noticed in our data through the SHARP survey that depressive symptoms are increasing with them as well.
Right. And you mentioned these grants from the Live On Foundation. How much are these grants?
So what they offered was a $10,000 mini grant. They offered several of them throughout the state. And so, in a small area like ours, that's a lot of money. We can really do a lot of good with a mini grant for $10,000.
Mm-hmm. And I see here that official proclamations will be given in Midway, Heber, and Wasatch County at their respective council meetings later this month. Why is it important to have local governments recognize this?
Yeah, I think, it shows that our local governments are also concerned about mental health. We've had a lot of discussions about it because of COVID and worrying about people and their mental health through COVID. But even prior to COVID, it was an issue. So it's been concerning you know, throughout. And so just the fact that our city and county governments are supporting that has been, you know, is really important to us that we have that.
Mm-hmm. I know youth suicide as it pertains especially to the LGBTQ community has been a passion of Governor Spencer Cox. Have you spoken with his office at all about these efforts? I know he's certainly in tune with this part of Utah.
Yes, we have, and we're so happy for his support. And we actually are, as part of the Live On campaign in Utah, we're doing some specific work with our secondary schools. So we have a high school and our two middle schools, and they are participating in a press conference next Tuesday at 10 o'clock. It's all over Zoom, and we have students joining in, but we have First Lady Abby Cox, who's going to be a speaker at our press conference as well. And so we really appreciate the support and our LGBTQ students, you know, in our schools are supported through this campaign as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about a little bit about some of these upcoming events. It looks like events throughout April and May. What are some of the highlights we should be circling on our calendars over the next few weeks?
Okay, we have some really exciting and great events going on. Some are virtually and some are in person. To kick everything off on April 21st, we have Kevin Hines speaking, and he will be a virtual presentation. And he is a mental health advocate, but he's also, but most importantly, he's a survivor of a suicide attempt. And he attempted to take his life by jumping off of the Golden Gate Bridge and actually survived it, which is very rare that that happens. And he tells a very powerful story about, you know, the second his hands left the rail, he knew he'd made a mistake. And he really just wanted to live. And that's such an important message for us to get out to people that, you know, the message of hope. And if people can just survive that crisis and get the hope and support that they need, you know, then they can really go on to do better, figure things out and have a good life, you know, and learn to manage their mental illness. And so he's going to be a great speaker. And we're hoping that he will do an interview with you as well. That's what we're working on. So that might be coming up in the future with KCTW. Then we have a couple of presentations for our Latino community. One is Javier Alegre from Salt Lake Behavioral Health. And he's going to give a presentation during lunch at our Wasatch Latino Coalition. We're also offering a QPR training in Spanish, which is Question, Persuade, and Refer. And it's just it's a 1 to 2 hour class that teaches people how to help somebody get help who might be in a mental health crisis. We also have a film viewing called The Upstanders, which is on bullying prevention. We have a gentleman named Pete Early on May 4th, another one of our nationally known speakers, and he's going to be talking about navigating the healthcare system if you have a loved one that has a mental illness. He had a son who struggled with mental illness, and he understands how hard it is to find help and get the right help, and so he's going to be talking that. So it's a great presentation for parents to join in or people who have a loved one that suffers from a mental illness. And then one of our fun events we have is we're doing Let's Talk About Mental Health Tuesdays. And we have some of our Mexican restaurants in Wasatch County joining in. They're offering a discount on Tuesdays in May, beginning on April 27th, Tuesdays in April and May. And if they mention Talk About Mental Health, they get a discount and they get a little packet of information that has some mental health resources in it. And then last of all, we have a yoga night for everybody in the community. It'll be held at Wasatch High School in the Nest from 7 to 8 on May 13th. And so we really have just tried to provide a whole variety of different types of presentations. So people can learn and become educated about all of these different things regarding mental wellness.
Absolutely. And it must be nice to have a mix of in-person and a virtual events now that we are hopefully nearing the end of this pandemic.
Yes. Yes, it is. And so we are really excited. We're glad we can do some of them in person. I think everybody is ready for that. But also it kind of made it more realistic if we could, bring people in virtually, some of our nationally known speakers. And so they're joining virtually. And the way to sign up or register for these virtual presentations is through our Caring Community Coalition of Wasatch County Facebook page. All the events will be on there. People can go in there, register. We're limited to 100 registrations to each of these virtual presentations. And so we're hoping that, people will join in Zoom per family and watch some of these as a family. One Zoom per household. So we have enough, we can get as many people watching as possible.
Absolutely. Any particular health guidelines for these in-person events people need to be aware of?
Yes, we will be following, all the regular social distancing and wearing a mask. Our yoga night will be at the high school. And so things do change rapidly by May 13th. But I think, right now we know that the mask guidelines are still going to be in place for school. And so people will be expected to wear a mask. And they're supposed to, if they have their own yoga mat, bring their own yoga mat to yoga. And, of course, restaurants, they'll be following the latest guidelines as well on Talk About Tuesday. So we are just moving forward and hoping we can provide some great education and information out to our community.
Wonderful. Anything else you want to add, Trudy, before we let you go?
I just want to thank, we've had so many people work on this and our sponsors. And so first off, just the liveonutah.org campaign has been so helpful. People's Health Clinic is a sponsor. They played a huge part in it. The Wasatch Community Foundation, our Wasatch Latino Coalition, of course, our Midway and Heber City governments and Wasatch County have all been very supportive. The school district has been a partner in this. We planned a lot of this with them on board, and Wasatch Behavioral Health, which is the agency that I work for, has also played a big part in this. So we couldn't do this without all of our partners, and we just appreciate everybody's partnership.
All right, Trudy, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy your Friday.
Thank you. You too.
All right, that's Trudy Breton. She's the Wasatch Behavioral Health Prevention Coordinator, talking about Mental Health Month. Well, after a 47-year run of providing his Swiss cooking and hospitality in a handful of different locations in Park City, Adolf Imboden is closing the doors to his popular restaurant on Kearns Boulevard at the end of the month. KBCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Adolf Imboden was born during World War II and lost his father at a young age. Without the financial resources, his passion for ski racing was diverted to learning a trade. His mother thought he had some talent for cooking, so at 16, he started a 3-year apprenticeship and then attended a hotel and restaurant management school. After giving Pauli Stern a ski lesson in St. Moritz, Switzerland, Adolf learned that the Sterns owned the Park City ski area before they sold it to develop Deer Valley Resort. They offered him a job as food and beverage manager of the resort, and he made the move to Park City in 1971 and ran the resort's food operations for 3 years. In 1974, he opened up a small restaurant at the bottom of Park Avenue. In 1977, he moved down the street to the city's golf course where he operated Adolf's restaurant, serving lunch on the patio and Sunday brunch, as well as dinner inside where the cathedral windows overlook the ski slopes and golf course. In 1997, Adolf and his longtime business partner secured the lease at a defunct restaurant on Kearns Boulevard, where a handful of chefs had tried to make a go of it on the off Main Street location. To date, Adolf's has been the only restaurant to succeed there. His fans followed, and he's hosted many celebrities, athletes, and ski racers over the years, as evidenced by the hundreds of signed photographs on the restaurant's walls. The University of Utah Ski Archives will be documenting many of the photos for its collection. After a difficult year of dealing with the impacts of the pandemic, Adolph wasn't quite ready to part with the business, but his hands were forced when he couldn't come to terms for a new lease with the building's new owner. While he knew the lease was ending, Adolph was surprised when an offer was taken off the table. At his age, almost 79, he felt a five-year lease was just too long at his age to commit to.
We pretty much had actually a deal in somewhere in January to extend the lease for 1 year with an option. Then that was changed around the middle of February to 5 years only. I was then luckily found a partner called EC and presented that to the landlord, but I was told that I was too late with the offer. So I was just not ready to sign a lease for 5 years at the time. So that's unfortunately how it happened. I think also for me, you know, I thought about my age and time, how long I've been here. So maybe everything happens for a reason. And I have so many ideas I still want to do and go on from here.
KPCW's request to the landlord for comment have not been returned. Adolph plans to stay open through the end of the month and then use the month of May to clear the building. At that point, it'll be the end of an era. The idea of an owner's chef working in the kitchen and visiting with guests on a nightly basis is pretty much a bygone these days.
You don't see that anymore, and you probably won't in the future. You know, you have managers and people who represent the restaurants. Then again, not too many restaurants are really named after the owner, so... At that time, when I first came here, you know, we started out with that. So then I did stay with that, and it was very successful all these years. And I didn't want to change that. And, of course, I was always happy to see my customers and talk to them and every night pretty much. And I have such a good crew there that did the rest.
In the days ahead, when he doesn't have to worry about staffing the restaurant, getting the food and liquor orders on in time, or fixing the never-ending equipment malfunctions, Adolph hopes to resume his guided tours of his hometown in Switzerland for skiing and hiking trips, as well as put together a photo and recipe book when he may finally publish the recipe for his famous house salad dressing. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
In the studio with us now, we have Terry Orr of TEDx Park City to talk all about TEDx Youth. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Sean.
Wonderful to have you here.
Oh, it's lovely to be in this space. It's stunning.
Absolutely. So let's talk about TEDx Youth. For some people, a lot of new people come to Park City. A lot of young families came to Park City over the past year. What is TEDx Youth?
TEDx Youth is a product of TED. So if you watch TED Talks, you know that this is an international, it's a global organization that their motto, their message is ideas we're spreading. And we were one of the first licenses that TED granted in 2009. We were one of the first 100 licenses. Today, there are 3,800 licenses globally. And out of that, there probably aren't 10 of us that do TEDx Youth. So what we do is we produce a day for the students, by the students, where they have a chance to give their own talks, and where we, you know, play some interesting, uplifting, amusing little snippets and videos between them. We used to have a great lunch and all kinds of hands-on activities that this year we feel is probably not prudent. But we'll do that again when we can.
Mm-hmm. I understand that the actual event is going to be in person. Is that correct?
You know, I think that it's not. So we had to dial that back, and we're going to do that on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And the filming of the students will be in person. So they'll be pre-recorded, and then the day will be put together with all the pieces that we have.
Mm-hmm. And the auditions are coming up next week, I believe?
They are.
13th and the 14th?
Yes, yeah. At 3:30. And those will be live at the Eccles Center in the main stage mm-hmm. Space.
Mm-hmm. And 10th through 12th grade are eligible, or is that expanded?
You know, we have said 8th and 9th as well. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to go back and say that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And what is this audition process like? Is it like auditioning for a school play? Are you in front of a panel of judges? How long does the audition need to be?
Well, I hope we're not judgy judges, but you are in front of a couple of folks and people who have been doing this with us for years. So Andy Mueller and Stacey Sayers and Kim and Steve Holmes, who I just can't say enough about, who do all the filming for us and have and will be running the boards the day we do the event. But when students come into audition, they should have an idea of something they want to share. And we're asking for about 3 minutes of time that they should be able to tell their story in that amount of time. And then we help them develop their talk. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a political format. You know, TED Talks are, again, about ideas we're sharing. So maybe we don't want to hear about, you know, your pet rat or something, unless it's changed your life, and then we're very interested in your pet rat.
Absolutely. Are there costs associated with it? Is there any cost to the kids who are listening?
No. This is it's a free event, and the costs that we incur, TED isn't allowed. You aren't allowed with the TED license to pay staff at all. So this is a volunteer effort. Mm-hmm. But we do have hard costs in terms of production. And so we have, you know, are in the process of raising some money. We are a nonprofit through TEDx San Diego. So we decided when we decided to do this separately from how it had been done in the past that creating another nonprofit in Park City was probably not what Park City needed and certainly not what we wanted to do. And so we teamed up with our sister organization in San Diego.
Mm-hmm. And with this event happening in May, will we get a more set date and a schedule coming soon?
We do know that the date in May is going to be May 19th. And then once we know the bones of what we're doing, we can let folks know. And we've had students, I just want to say, it's remarkable what these young people create. And some of their talks they have used to get into Harvard and Stanford and Salt Lake Community College. We have kids from all across the spectrum who speak. And they speak about things they're passionate about in some cases. And one young girl talked about her dinosaur socks and how that gave her power the days that she wore them. And one young Latinx woman talked about what it meant to be Latinx with mental health issues in Park City and how complicated that was for her to navigate. Mm-hmm. You can go onto our site, tedx.org, and you can see the YouTube channel, and you will see the talks there that we have done since 2009 for both adult TED events and for TEDx Youth.
Mm-hmm. And speaking to the fact that it is going to be a virtual event, TEDx is now a veteran of putting on these virtual events over the past year. I believe we've had you on to talk about the climate action event that TEDx put on and then the women's event as well. How did those go and what did you learn that you can then put into TEDx Youth now that it's going to be virtual?
We learned a lot about production values, as you know, something you all know very well. But we learned that people are very forgiving, especially in a pandemic, that they were so hungry for content that if there was this a little blip that we would have been mortified about, nobody was losing sleep over it. We also learned how adaptable we can be and how many more people can come to an event because it's much easier to sit in your living room than it is to drive in your car and get a babysitter and do all those things. So we had great turnout for TED Climate and TED Women. And it just felt good to see faces again, even if they were on screen.
Mm-hmm. And is there a registration deadline for these auditions coming up, or do they just show up?
They just show up, and that's kind of the fun of it. We're hoping to have 10 to 12 speakers again. We've had fewer and we've had more, but that seems to be a pretty good zone. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they learn what's called presentation literacy, which is kind of a fancy way of saying stage presence and being able to communicate with an audience in a way that hopefully would help you if you are trying to get a job, if you are interviewing in a school, all of those same things. We teach them about don't wear the dangly earrings and don't wear the, you know, plaid shirt or the stripes that the camera's going to go crazy with.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to add, Terry?
No, just if folks are interested, they can call me at 435-640 3142, or you can go to tedx.org, and you can donate to help us do this, or you can just ask a question, or you can volunteer to help us with the kids. It's all things that we need.
All right, Terry, thank you so much. Terry Orr with TEDx Park City. TEDx Youth auditions are April 13th and April 14th at Park City High School. Terry, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean.
Right. Well, the Summit County Council on Wednesday didn't make a decision on their planned neighborhood mixed-use zone or their master plan development process, which is closely tied to the new zone. Councilmember Melina Stevens said they're crafting the language carefully on both to avoid any unintended consequences. Rick Bruff has more.
The council held a public hearing on the MPD process, but of three citizens who spoke, two were from the Canyons Resort area. They have told the county before they're concerned that the mixed-use zone might be used to overturn the specially planned area agreement for the Canyons that's been in effect for over 20 years. Michael Bradley said he's trying to represent 130 like-minded residents in the Lower Canyons area. He said the language in the mixed-use zone doesn't make it clear enough that the zone and the MPD process couldn't be used unless the canyon spa comes to the end of its term. He said developers shouldn't get the wrong message.
We sit with 130 people with heightened arousal every time something comes up, to the point where we actually hire an attorney to make sure to keep an eye on things, because this will continue and it will continue to persist in our community. Despite people saying it's not appropriate for the canyons, people will look to develop there. I want the group to kind of think about, you bought a home in a resort community based on spa with the understanding that it would be governed by such, and it truly being a neighborhood. And the fact that you could have a three-story building put up right next to your home because of some of the latitude in what is being put into this, you know, new NMU-1 with MPD.
His neighbor Bradley Graveline also said the language should be stronger. Melina Stevens told KPCW they're still working to get the appropriate language.
There's still some concern with that. So really, we're just trying to figure out what's going to work best to both give the flexibility that is needed in other areas, but also to ensure that specific people feel comfortable that live within the canyons and some other areas.
Another speaker at the hearing, Leslie Masters, was concerned the mixed-use zone would affect the proposed development in another area.
I just am a little worried that the NMU might be used as a free-for-all in some of the new neighborhoods. Highland Flats, are they going to suddenly come in and try the NMU rezoning?
Stevens had this response.
Within the neighborhood mixed-use zone, there's previously identified areas, and those are the only areas that would be eligible to apply for a rezone to the neighborhood mixed-use zone. Just to clarify, that doesn't mean that those areas will automatically or have some sort of predetermination that they will become neighborhood mixed-use zones, but those are the only places that have been identified as appropriate. Highland Flats was not one of those areas.
The council on Wednesday hammered out other provisions for the mixed-use zone. They said a single retail use in the zone would be at most 50,000 square feet. Stevens said that is responding to some basin areas that desperately need a grocery store. On another topic, she said they haven't decided how much affordable housing should be required in an NMU development.
I know yesterday we played with some numbers such as 50% of the housing within an NMU needs to be affordable. We haven't finalized that yet, but that's something we're looking at.
Councilmember Melina Stevens, who added that the Snyderville Planning Commission is working on the overall problem of affordable housing and what income levels they want to serve. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.